Hello, and welcome to ContraPulse. I'm Julie Valamont. In this podcast series, we'll be conducting interviews with contra musicians and talking to them about their craft. What kind of music do you play for contra dancing? Why do you choose the tunes that you do? How did you learn to play? What, in your mind, makes the dancers move? How do you think contra dance is changing? What's your idea of perfect contra dance music? We'll be exploring all those things, hearing stories from their experiences, and stories from the dance floor. And we'll begin to get a sense of what's happening and how the contra scene is changing. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're hearing from Dudley Laufman. I was very happy to be able to find some time to sit down with Dudley in the woods at Maine Fiddle Camp last summer, along with his daughter, Lindsay Holden. Dudley is often at Maine Fiddle Camp in the summertime. He comes to teach accordion and share stories, and he also leads the evening dance. The barn dance is a big hit, there's always lots of people who come, and the stage is full of musicians who sit in with him as he leads the band, as is tradition. So many folks that they often don't all fit on the stage. Dudley has been playing and calling dances for over 50 years. He's been the leader of the Canterbury Country Dance Orchestra, which has several recordings. Dudley helped keep contra dancing going. And Dudley dancers, as they are called, went to his dances in the 60s, and since then have spread them throughout the country. Many of our contra dances today around the country can be traced back to Dudley dances. He is a recipient of a 2009 National Heritage Fellowship awarded by the NEA, which is the United States' highest honor in the folk and traditional arts. We're very happy to talk with him today and hear some of his stories and experiences over the years. Thank you so much, Dudley, for joining us.
Okay, fire away.
Fire away. Thank you so much. So, I'm curious to get a sense of how contra music has changed over the years and the tunes that you were playing then. I know you're still calling now. So, where do you want to start? Do you want to talk about the kind of dances that you call now versus then and the tunes that go with them? Or how do you pick tunes?
All right. I'll answer that. For a whole evening, I like to make an even, more or less even arrangement between jigs and reels.
Mm-hmm.
So one dance will be for jig, the next one will be for a reel or a hornpipe. And I try to vary that. And then when I'm working with people who don't dance very much, I very seldom do squares.
Mm-hmm.
Takes too long to get them in, the squares, particularly at a wedding. You get them all in there, and then somebody say, oh, I've got to say goodbye to the bride. And they'll leave.
And then the square can't.
Yeah, so I don't usually do the square dances. But and when I choose a tune, like I say, either like a jig or a reel, but I also like to arrange the keys, although I'm not too fussy about that. But
mm-hmm.
if that's something, if I've got a whole bunch of tunes in the key of G, I try to find something that'll go into D, just to give a little variation on it. But In the regular, or not regular, but the contra dance today, from what I see of it, they use three tunes per dance, what
mm-hmm.
they call medleys.
Mm-hmm.
I never do that.
Mm.
I never have. The only time that I did medleys was on the original Sir Roger de Coverley Virginia reel. It was done to the first part where the corners come. That was done to a jig. And then the reel, they stripped the willow, was done to a reel.
Mm-hmm.
And then the processional, the march around, was done to a march. And at the dance that I used to go to at Mistral Farm, he played Larry O'Gaff for the jig,
mm-hmm.
McLeod's reel for the reel,
mm-hmm.
and John Brown's body for the march. And they never changed. And that was right out of the Henry Ford book. And so that was, you could call that a medley.
Mm-hmm.
And as a dancer, you had to pay attention to it because you couldn't go marching around when they were still playing the reel. And if we did, Betty Quimby would let us know,
mm-hmm.
In certain terms. But otherwise, I rarely will do a medley. First of all, I got enough to do. Play the accordion, call the dance, manage the floor. If Sylvia is playing for me, I ask her to, I say, if you're insistent on doing a medley, you pick it. And tell me when you're going to change and that sort of thing. Otherwise, I don't. But that seems to be a big thing with the modern contra dance bands, medleys of three tunes per dance mostly, and then the kinds of tunes, I think a lot of them are traditional tunes, but it's the way they played. They played faster, and sometimes there's some blues riffs in it and jazz. Mm-hmm. But mostly it's the speed, and there's the difference between when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid growing up, the first dances I went to were at Mr. Old Farm, and when he'd play for the Virginia Reel, I just told you what he played for that, but they would do a square dance to Hinky Dinky Parley-Voo. And they would do another one to, there was another tune they used. Oh yeah, Captain Jinx. And until I went off to agricultural school, I thought that's all it was. But I went to the Aggie down in Walpole, Mass. My pomology instructor, that's the trees, apple trees.
Yeah.
He and his wife ran square dances. We had square dancing every Monday night at the gym. And they were, that was where I learned about dancing more to it. And then one of the fellows told me, he said, you know, if you're going to continue doing this, you've got to stop skipping. And I said, well, that's the way I did it. It doesn't matter. He said, you've got to stop skipping. Keep your feet close to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a little bit more about the proper way of doing it. And but when you went to off to square dance then, I used to go to dance to Ralph Page. And he had a dance every Tuesday night at the Boston YWCA. And he had a band. It was his Boston Orchestra. They did not do medleys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were two of the musicians played at the Boston Symphony. I mean, they were very
skilled musicians.
Yeah, yeah, and they were good too. And they could play Walter Loeb could play the Devil's Dream like you never heard it. It was really something, you know. And he just died recently. And at that hall in the YWCA, it was all a room that was all white with chandeliers, and it had a very polished feeling to it. And the dancers were very smooth. Mostly from MIT, you know, and they just sort of glided across the floor. And occasionally Ralph Page would do the Money Musk and everybody groaned, including me, because it wasn't much fun. But I went up to a dance in Peterborough one time, and Ralph had his New Hampshire Orchestra there, which consisted of Dick Richardson and Russ Allen on fiddles, and Johnny Trombley on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that taught Bob McQuillan about recording, and Junior Richardson on the stand-up bass, and then Bob McQuillan on the accordion. And that music was the best I've ever heard.
Mm.
And Ralph did more squares than contras in those days. He was a singing caller.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the boys. He was in the union. He advocated the use of ski boots. And he changed somewhere in there. But he was really liked the square dances. And he would play in town halls that had a pretty rough crowd that would come. And he did that for a long time. But the band, that New Hampshire Orchestra.
Yeah, let's talk more about the band.
Okay, they were something.
Yeah, what about it? You say it was like the best music you ever heard.
It's the sound.
Yeah.
It's the sound. They played, when I heard them first, was at the Bell Studio, which was a place called Folkways in Peterborough, and it was an old barn, and it had a sprung floor.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who came were local farmers and wood choppers, factory workers, and summer folks. And it was a good mixture. There was no computer programmers. And it was a great mixture for the dance. And Ralph Page did squares like Red River Valley and Hinky Dinky Parley-Voo and Golden Slippers, sang all the calls.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he did contras, it was Money Musk, Chorus Jig, Lady Walpole's Rio, Morning Star, that's what. Mm-hmm. And there was another caller there, Gene Gowing, and he would do Durang's Hornpipe dances like that. But the music itself was very rich.
Mm-hmm. Instrumentation.
Yeah,
wise.
It was. Yeah, the accordion, mm-hmm. two fiddles,
mm-hmm.
and they were playing mostly in unison. Russ would go into harmony once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
He was trained. Dick was not trained, and but they. I one time had Dick's fiddle. His daughter gave me the fiddle, and I had it for a while, because I wasn't using it. I gave it back, but it was one of his fiddles.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we were asked to do a dance in Marlborough, where Dick came from. And the Marlborough Historical Society wanted me to, I wrote a book about Dick,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted me to do a culminating event where we would talk about the book, and then we'd have some dance. And so Bob was there playing one of his big old accordions.
Mm-hmm.
And
and Johnny on piano?
No, he was gone by
okay,
that time.
Okay, okay. So we're talking about a different time
yeah.
now.
Carl Jacobs played the bass, but he had heard Junior, so he knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing Dick Richardson,
mm-hmm.
and Jacqueline was playing Russ Allen,
mm-hmm.
and Yeah, that was the crowd.
Who would have been on piano?
Larry Siegel. He's the one that wrote that play about me, the dancing master of Canterbury. And so, and I played them recordings of the band, and we couldn't do it. We just could not get that sound. Close, came very close, but it didn't have that magic. Now, one thing about the magic of that was that when you get the whole band playing was great, but when, during the Korean War, McQuillan went off. Mm-hmm. Went to a dance in Hancock one night, and it was Junior, Russ, and Johnny, and Dick. And it had that sound. No accordion, but it still had that sound. And then I went to another dance one time, and Russ wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So it was Junior, Dick, and Johnny. And then one time I had a dance in my house, and Junior and Dick came down and played for it. Didn't even have Johnny. And then another dance was on, and had to do Junior. Was sick or drunk or something, and I just had Dick, and that was it. Dick was the key.
He was the magic.
He was the one that made that magic, yeah.
What was his fiddle style from, do you know?
He was untrained. It was all on his wrist. His right wrist was bigger than his left wrist, and it was just the way he played. And it just had and I've tried to duplicate it, and I can't do it, and I wasn't able to do it, even with the instrumentation. Was not able to. Came close, but not the same.
Are there recordings of him?
Well, you know, they made some recordings. I think it was late 38 or in the 40s on the disc label, and there were 78s and 78 RPMs. And Ralph did an album of New England singing calls. And so there was Jingle Bells and Girl Up Behind Me in Red River Valley. Soldier's Joy was on there, but he sang. He sang the notes to that. And the combination, I think, was Dick Richardson, and it was a banjo player, Junior on the bass, Johnny Trumbly on the piano, and someone else. It was close, pretty close. And then, but anyway, later on, Michael Herman, down in New York City, ran the folk dance house, folk dancer. And he got Ralph to come down there to New York and put on some dances, and then finally decided to make some recordings. So he got... There were two sets. Ralph had a band in Boston, and that was the Gagliasi Brothers and Phil Jamulis, and they had a very Boston sound, very smooth, a little fast. And so I did a bunch of recordings with them. He recorded Petronella and Opera Rio and Turkey and the Star and Canadian Breakdown, a couple of others. And, oh no, the ones that he did with just the Boston boys were Crooked Stovepipe, Chinese Breakdown, Silver and Gold Two-Step, and a couple of others, just the three. So they recorded those, and then Ralph would put them on call to them. So they had both with and without calls. And it was pretty smooth music, you know. And then they were joined by Walter Erickson. And he was a studio accordion player from New York. Mm-hmm. And so he changed the sound quite a bit. He was very loud. And but they did Opera Reel, Petronella, and Canadian Breakdown. And that was, again, with and without the calls. And then he did a batch with Dick and Junior and Johnny, just those three. And they recorded Chorus Jig, Money Musk, Climbing the Golden Stairs, Real Stumpy, and a couple of others, and did those without the calls, and then did the same thing with the calls.
Do you know where those recordings are now?
Yeah, the Ralph Page Memorial Collection in Durham. I've got some at home.
Yeah.
And then they were joined by Walter Erickson, and they did Gleeson Sherbrooke. Mm. And that Gleeson Sherbrooke sold over a million copies.
Wow.
In those days, that was something.
Yeah, it was that's a, 10, a lot of copies.
10-inch, then a 12-inch, 78. But Dick didn't like Walter. Because when Walter was playing, he was very emphatic, and he'd inch closer to the microphone, and he'd drown Dick out, and Dick didn't like that too well. Mm-hmm. But other, and they recorded a little bit too fast. It was evidently Ralph had to squeeze a certain amount of the dance into the amount of time.
Oh,
they had.
I see.
So it was played a little fast, but
a little fast for a dance tempo, which
but
is good
bad.
To know for anyone who's listening to those recordings now to know that's not the tempo they would have danced in.
That's right. Yeah. And it was also for a while there until they did something that you couldn't play a harmonica along with the record and you weren't quite the same pitch. But that got changed because when I was learning to play harmonica, I was able to use the records. Mm. But I thought I'd died and gone to heaven when those records came out. And I just played them over and over again.
How old were you then?
16, 17.
Yeah. So you were kind of growing up playing those.
Yeah.
Like when I wanted to learn to play country music, I listened to the New England Chestnuts albums.
Yeah.
And Bob McQuillan albums.
Yeah.
And so for you, this was like that for you.
Sure.
These were the albums you were listening to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't use, when I first, I called my first dance to, at Norfolk County Agricultural High School. They were all Paul Mass, and I used a recording, and it was on Star Label, the French. And the tune was Reel de Gondolier, which was really the Crooked Sawpipe, except it was crooked. And it wouldn't wait for me when it was calling, you know.
So
I said to Mrs. Ashman, I said, can you do this on the piano? I said, I don't like that. And from then on, I've never used live music. I did use, I mean, recorded music. For a while there, I was training myself to call, and I would use those records to train, you know, teach myself how to call. And then when I was up at the University of Mass, we had a dance at Bowditch Hall. It was the 4-H Hall. And I liked to dance. So, and I didn't have any musicians, so I put the record on it. Mm-hmm. That was about, it didn't take me long to get into live music and then stay that way.
Mm. Now, did you, when you moved to New Hampshire and you joined the dance scene there, what was that experience like?
Well, when I first moved, at that particular time, there was really a dearth of musicians.
Mm-hmm.
They were all dying off. Up in our area, we had Hiram Gardner, and there were a couple of others who played fiddles. But at that time, Bob McQuillan was playing, and he was only playing the keyboard. Accordion, he wasn't mm-hmm. playing the keyboard. And I could get him and Sylvia,
mm-hmm.
and there were a couple of others, but really there wasn't much.
Piano players?
No.
Hmm.
But I had Joe Ryan. Did you ever hear him?
No.
Yeah, well, he lived in Northfield, New Hampshire, and he lived off in the woods. But he built some yurts and encouraged people to come live there. So Bonnie Raitt,
mm-hmm.
her brother came by there, and her father, and Bonnie, she lived there for a while too. And then the Hanson brothers, and so we began to get some young people involved, interested in the music. And my ex-wife Cynthia played the piano, and Sylvia on the accordion. Nicholas S. Howe was playing fiddle, and I was playing accordion and calling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the beginning to get that going. And then we got invited down to Newport Folk Festival in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled together a bunch of musicians, not McQuillan.
Mm-hmm.
He was off on some other track then. He wasn't interested. But I had Walter Loeb
mm-hmm.
and Dave Fuller. Dave played the accordion, and Nicholas Howe and Newt Tolman on the flute.
Oh, yeah.
And then I bought some dancers down from Nelson.
And yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, we stole the show. It was great. That was the same year that Bob McQuillan went electric.
Bob McQuillan went electric.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan.
I'm sorry.
Okay, good. I was like, but this is another story. Yeah. That would be cool.
I'm sorry. My words.
I understand.
Yeah. So, anyway, and I didn't find out about him doing that until I was on my way home. And I heard news on the radio, and they tell about how Bob Dylan went electric.
Hmm.
But when we came off the stage from playing, there was about 10 of us playing. It was a pretty rich sound. And there were about eight couples dancing. And I asked everybody to dress up like they do in Nelson. So I was wearing a white suit. Mm-hmm. And everybody wears a suit and tie. Women had fairly long dresses. But there was one couple that came, Lauren Puffer. He lived in Loudoun, New Hampshire, and he wasn't a Monadnock Regioner. And he and his wife had only been to a couple of dances, but I wanted people to see the audience to see what this is like.
Mm-hmm. So was that normal for everyone to wear suits, or was this like a special occasion?
No, they just a pretty tweedy bunch.
So if you were just playing a regular dance, what would you wear?
Suit and tie.
Suit and tie.
Yeah.
People would dress up to come to the dance.
There was no sneakers and jeans in those days.
Yeah, now people just wear whatever they want, shirts,
that's right.
T-shirts.
Yeah. The way that it's changing a little bit. The most women dress up when I see them at dances mm-hmm. these days. But the guys, they wear black shoes, black socks up to here, then shorts, running shorts, and white legs, and they haven't tanned yet, and then a tank top. I can't imagine a woman wanting to dance with them. I just can't imagine it. But they're beginning to change. Guys are beginning to wear trousers. And
so you're talking about this full, rich sound.
Yeah.
What would be your perfect fantasy contraband? Like, what would it have in it?
That would have in it.
Accordion, two fiddles,
accordion, string bass, and piano.
String bass, piano. Yeah. No guitar.
No.
You haven't talked about guitar at all, really.
No. Well, I mean, recently, you know, we've got a guitar player now, Bob Reed,
mm-hmm.
who's in Tuftonboro, New Hampshire, and he plays guitar for us a lot. And he's the only one. Mm-hmm. And he's really good.
Mm-hmm. Really, really and good. Is it guitar and piano, or one or the other?
No. One or the other. Used to, both.
Yeah, not the same time. Well,
sometimes we do. The other night we had Dancing Nelson, and we had Gordon Peary on the piano, and Randy Miller on the fiddle, and Lindsay on the fiddle, and me on the accordion, and Sam.
Sam, the accordionist from here.
Yeah, well, he lives in Nelson, you see.
So
he showed up, and then there was a fellow playing electric guitar, and then we had a saxophone player for a while.
Electric guitar, bold.
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, like, Air Dance had guitar and piano for a long time with David Surrett, sometimes mandolin.
Yeah.
What do you think of that sound?
That's a nice sound, but it's the sound I like is the one that I told you about. Excuse me, and I guess the thing that I lament is that I haven't been able to or find anybody to reproduce that. And Bob McCullough and I both agree that that was a very elusive sound.
Yeah, I would love to go back to listen to those recordings of him and figure out, is it the groove he's playing with or just the way he plays
the
tunes?
Recordings, the 78 recordings with Walter Erickson on the accordion were close. Mm-hmm. Again, didn't have it. There was an echo to that barn. But like I say, it's Dick Richardson. It was just him, mm-hmm. no matter where he was playing, even in my cellar. You know, it just had a thing to the way he played it. Mm-hmm. The way he played it, the lilts and the bowing. And it's fantastic. I've never seen anything like it. But you were asking about back in those days then, they didn't do medleys.
Yeah.
They didn't do medleys, and the tempo was apt to be more moderate. Fast.
Yeah, let's talk about tempo for a second, because I think modern dancers expect faster tempos, and I think it's a big difference in the way they're moving. And some people, you know, have said, well, it's about the footwork, and that when people, like, say you have a dance where there's actives and inactives, and you're out and you're not dancing, you could be doing some footwork.
Yeah.
And then the slower tempos are better. Like, can you talk about how the tempos fit the dance then?
Yeah.
And how you like them now?
Yeah, well, the tempos then were slower, mm-hmm. and that made the music feel richer. Now, that was in the Monadnock region. In Boston, mm-hmm. it was faster.
Mm-hmm.
And people doing step dancing in those days, they didn't. Mm-hmm. When they were inactive, they were inactive.
They just hang out.
Watch what was going on, mm-hmm. learning something, mm-hmm. but they didn't have to be boogieing all the time. Now you, of course, jig. Now, besides the fact they played a ridiculous tune for the second tune, when the actives are going down the outside, the inactives are going swing in the middle. That changes it. It's not chorus jig anymore.
Yeah.
And
so would you rather no opera reel? You would just rather have
well, why did they pick that up anyway, opera reel? It's a great tune.
It's a great tune, but why there?
Yeah, well, the only reason that I can think of is that the dance is similar to chorus jig, the dance opera reel.
No one dances the dance opera reel anymore.
Well, they do if I'm playing for contra dances, I'll mm-hmm. do that dance. And I suggest to them, play chorus jig as an alternate tune. They don't like it. They just don't like it.
That's funny.
But chorus jig, I'll drop out if it's not that tune. You know, it's got to be that tune. And I remember one time down at Buffalo Gap, I was hired to come down there and play. And I had Sylvia and Taylor Whiteside and Vince. And after supper, they'll have a little aperitif. And then if the evening program ends, they'll do some dancing. So we lined up there in the dining room. And I said, well, let's do chorus jig. So I had a bunch of musicians there, so I danced. Sylvia was playing. I got down near the end, and she switched into the deer song that Bob McCormick wrote. What's it called? What's the song that Bob McCormick wrote about deers?
I don't know.
Not the deer hunter. Dancing Bear.
Dancing Bear, yeah.
So she switched into that. Well, it's in minor.
Oh, yeah, she told us about that.
Yeah, switched into that. And so afterwards, and so I dropped out. And then afterwards I came up to give her hell. And I said, Jesus, go, what the hell did you change into that for? She said, if you know what size your bread's buttered on, you'll do it.
So,
Then I used to be able to say, you haven't won the governor's award, but you did.
Then you couldn't hold that over her anymore.
Yeah.
So how long would you, like, today it seems very standard. This is like a little thing I wonder about. It seems very standard for a band to need to play two or three tunes. And they almost think most of the time the one tune is like, you shouldn't do that. It's like too boring.
Yeah.
It needs to be interesting. And are the dances being run longer than they used to? Or did people just expect something different back then? Like, would you do chorus jig for 8 minutes, 10 minutes?
Yep.
Not get bored of that
nope,
tune?
Never. Never, ever get bored. Yeah. In fact, if anybody gets bored playing this music, they have no business playing it. They should go do something else. The tunes are meant for constant repetition, and you can do things with them if you want. I like playing them the same way all the time, but you can play them in such a manner that you can play around with the tunes. Mm-hmm. You don't need to switch to another one.
Mm-hmm.
One time, we went to a dance in Concord, Mass. It was the Cotillion. And Tony Parks was calling, and a mixture of Wild Asparagus and Swallowtail mm-hmm. bands. And they're good, they had a good sound. So anyway, Tony said, we're going to do the Money Musk. So I got up there with Ernie Spence. Did you know Ernie Spence? Yeah. Great dancer. And so we went down the line together. Well, we got about three quarters of the way down, and they changed tunes. So we both dropped out.
Of the dance.
And went and leaned against the wall and said, you can't dance this to anything but Money Musk. Then they switched back, so we jumped back in. You know. Afterwards, I went up to Tony, what's his name? Peter. And I said, what's this? What are you changing for? And he said, the fiddlers get tired and they get bored. And I said, the feet won't work unless it's that tune. He wrote it down in his notebook, and it's still there, as far as I know. Mm. Dudley says, feet won't work unless we use the tune.
Well, that's the thing. You learn the dance and you learn how your body goes with the phrases of the tune. Why would you want to change that halfway?
Well, they get bored.
Yeah.
Now, Money Musk is hard to play. That's tough on the fingers. But there's ways of getting around that, too. You don't have to play all the notes.
Mm-hmm.
John Kirkpatrick wrote he's an accordion player from England, wrote a great essay called Medley Mania.
Hmm.
And he said, one of these days I'm going to run a workshop and we're going to play Bobby Shafto till it comes out our ears.
That's great. So, if you were playing with Canterbury Dance Orchestra, would you just pick one tune and play that per dance?
Yep.
Yeah. Do you call dances that feel like modern contra dances?
No. Well, I've been to dances where they do modern dances.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly enamored of them. Now, partly is that I'm losing my balance and I don't like to move that fast. But I don't feel I have to be moving all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind standing still and watching. You might learn something when you watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not particularly enamored of them. And a lot of them, I get the feeling that the callers are inventing new ones. Now, there could be a reason, lots of reasons why they do it, but one is that they want their time in the limelight, and because everybody's doing something here. It's creative, you know, and so they want to make a show, so they make something that's maybe more difficult than the one before them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get these dances that have gypsies and haze and once in 5/8 around, you know. I mean, I just don't enjoy that. I rather have my feet close to the floor and do a little jigging and be able to relate to my partner and anyone else on the floor. And I'm not interested in doing a dance that has a partner-neighbor swing. It doesn't matter. As long as you get your partner swing.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I don't like Lady Walpole's Reel, because you don't swing with your partner, you just swing with your neighbor.
Mm.
But I have written a couple of dances, but they're all in the old, really traditional. But I wrote one to Morgan Megan. The tune Morgan Megan, which, do you know that tune? It's an Irish tune.
I've heard it.
Yeah. Well, it feels like it's got 28 measures, but it's not. It's got 32. They're just the way they fall. So I wrote a dance to fit that. And I've written a couple of others, but that's not particularly what I'm interested in doing. I've written 15 tunes also.
Mm-hmm.
And then three tunes that have variations. I wrote one called Mozart, which is a variation on his K417.
Mm-hmm.
And one on Haydn and one on Handel.
But you turned them into New England dance tune, Phil?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
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 So what is a good dance tune in your mind?
Money Musk.
Even though you said people didn't like the dance much.
In Boston. Oh, no. I finished that. When I went up to New Hampshire, there was that band, the New Hampshire band, and there was a girl there. There were three of them. They're all redheads. The Ramsey girls.
Mm-hmm.
And their father ran the post office. So June Ramsey was the one I wanted to dance with, and I went and asked her for the next dance. She said, well, I've got the next tour book, but the one after that will be Money Musk. You can do that one. I said, I don't want to dance Money Musk with you. And she said, you wait. Jesus. The Williams twins were there. Alan Williams still alive. Art Williams, Alan Williams, well, taps on their shoes.
Hmm.
And they did this shuffle clog on that thing. The music was slow, I mean, by a nice tempo. and Ralph chanted that call, and of course there was that great band. But everybody knew the dances, and if they didn't, they'd get pushed, shoved through it. But Money Musk was just, that had a special quality to it, in the way we were dancing it. So, I don't know what I was talking about.
You were talking about the thinner sound.
That's what they wanted, a thinner kind of sound, and they really wanted Irish music, and they wanted us to go that way. They wanted the Canterbury Orchestra to go that way, and I said, you guys got to go off on your own, and which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, that's I just said, you know, that's okay. Just, mm-hmm. That's not what I want to do. But I did make a recording with Randy and Fred Brunig and Jack Perrin and myself. It was called Itinerant License. I did it myself. And I wanted to appease those guys, and so I tried to do it their way. And I was in charge of selling the recording, and we went out of print, you know, but it wasn't my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my favorite. And the recording that Bill runs the record company over there in Voorheesville, New York. I can't think of the name, but anyway, we produced a recording called, I'm having an awful time. There's a reel, an Irish reel, I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, he wanted us to do that, and we did. We spent a week there,
mm-hmm.
had to play every tune 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
When we do the Canterbury Orchestra once, it's once.
Yeah.
That's it. You just one time
once,
through.
One take, that's all you get.
Yeah, and if it doesn't work, forget it. We won't do it. So, and no medleys. We don't do any medleys.
I notice that bands that I play a lot less jigs these days.
Well, we play quite a few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you like? Like, what role do jigs have for the dance?
They just fit the dance. They're bouncy,
yeah.
You know.
They're
some,
bouncy.
Some dances work both ways.
Yeah.
Morningstar works as well to a jig or a reel. And some dances work much better as a jig.
Yeah. So you think of jigs as being bouncy?
Well, sort
most of.
Most
of the
yeah,
time.
But I went to a dance out in Wisconsin one time, and a woman came in. She was kind of tough. She had a big badge on, said, no jigs.
That's funny. Because now a lot of callers ask for jigs when they want something smooth. They say smooth jigs.
Yeah. Well, they don't know what they're talking about, anyway, most of them.
Yeah. It's interesting that I feel like as a dance musician that the role of jigs has changed, where jigs used to be bouncy, but now people ask for them when they want something smooth, which I don't always understand.
Yeah.
Because a good bouncy jig is
a
mighty thing.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like most musicians think reels are what you play most of the time, with the occasional jigs sprinkled in.
Well, in the Southern Mountains, they don't do jigs. In fact, I've got a recording of somebody playing, and he tries to play Pop Goes the Weasel, and it segues into 2/4 time.
Wow. So those guys are trying to bring in the Irish influence. What was it like for you when you saw bands like Swallowtail forming, or Wild Asparagus, or eventually Nightingale?
Yeah, I didn't know much about them. I was very busy at that time. Had all the gigs I could handle, and then some. So I really wasn't paying much attention to it. But like I say, I thought, well, maybe I should at least learn something about this. And that's why we did the record, Itinerant Musician's License. But the Canterbury Orchestra was the way I wanted to do it.
So if you're going to think of the quintessential contra dance band, like, what was it like well before you and the Canterbury Dance Orchestra? Do you think it was fiddles and pianos?
Yeah.
Mostly?
Yeah. And then when McCollin came along with the accordion, but it was mostly fiddles.
Mm-hmm.
String bass, cello type of thing. And if they didn't, you know, before the day of the keyboard, they had drums or cello to carry the bass.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the tempos are faster in Boston?
Well, they lead a faster life. It's a faster pace to the life.
Huh, that's interesting.
So I think that has to do with it. And also the complicated dances has to do with it. They bring the work right into the dance.
Yeah.
Which is kind of too bad, I think.
Huh.
I kind of like it. The dance has got an entity in it itself, got a life of its own, and I don't think it'd be reflecting computer programmers. But that's me.
Because I notice the dancers kind of want a certain kind of thing. They want a certain kind of calling, and they want a certain kind of music.
Yeah.
So these things, like, feed each other
in
a way. And it seems like dancers want faster tempos, and they want flashy tunes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they want kind of exciting moments and things like
and
that.
And I think that a lot of the dancers, when the the band will change keys, and the bands, that's the dancers will go, they'll holler. You know?
Yeah.
My guess would be that most of them don't even know that something's happened. They're making the holler because everybody else is, but they're not aware that something has happened.
So the magic in a slower dance, when I had a friend call it shock and awe contra dancing, when you're like taking the dancers on a roller coaster ride, but you're taking the attention away from the community and putting it like on the music on the dance experience.
Yeah.
So when it's like a slow tempo and one tune for a whole time, how do the dancers spend their time? Like chatting to each other, or like where's their focus if it's not on the music? Because you can kind of tune the tune out at that point. You know, if jig's been going on for 5 minutes straight. I just wonder if it's their attention is in a different place.
I don't know. I know that in my particular case, if I'm dancing with Lindsay, I eye contact, even though we're not active.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm relating to her as well as to the whole dance. To me, it's a social function. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether I'm working with adults that dance or adults that don't dance or with kids. It's courtship, even with kids. They may not know it, and the teachers may not know it, but that's what's happening. And I think that's the role of this kind of dancing. And it's important in that it's it has a little bit more to it than rock and roll, and there's nothing wrong with that either.
Mm-hmm.
But it has more to it. It really does tie into the community and the courtship part more, I think. Now, that's, you know, I mean, some of the tunes... there's a lot of emotion with some of these tunes. Some of them can bring tears to my eyes. It's the way they played, when they played, where they played. But it's just this, the way those notes rise and fall. There's a tune called Enrico. I taught it to Katie. Was it Katie? Katie Newell, the daughter. Yeah.
Maisie.
Yeah. And when she was a kid, she still plays it. It's a tune called Enrico or Jacob. It's a hornpipe. And but when Thomas Hardy was a young boy, he was 4 or 5 years old, played in a family band, he had one of those little melodeons, and his dad would play that tune. He had to leave the room. He'd cry. And he was embarrassed, so he'd go in the other room and cry. So... All right.
So yesterday we left off talking about, I'm interested in this idea of like what in your mind is the perfect contra dance music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Did I say anything?
Yeah, you did. You talked about fiddle style a little bit, and we talked about medleys and tempo.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of tempo is ideal for you?
Well, for me, I have a tendency to play a little fast. Because I'm used to playing for children who dance faster.
Mm-hmm.
But my preference is to have it fairly slow.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then I play for Morris side, and I have a tendency to go with the Bampton tradition, which is faster.
Mm-hmm.
So the leader of our Morris team is always saying, slow, slow down.
Mm-hmm.
But I like a moderate tempo.
Is that like a dun kind of tempo? Or?
Let's see. About like that.
Okay.
Yeah, moderate.
Good. That's good to know. That's good to know. So what in your mind makes the tune the perfect tune for contra dancing?
Well, there's more than one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Enrico, Jacob. That's a tune that Thomas Hardy played when he was a kid. And, well, of course, the standard, you know, Money Musk. But those are named. Do you want a generic tune that would be perfect?
Yeah, like if you're playing for a dance that doesn't have a tune that goes along with
it. Yeah, well, Enrico is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then for jigs, well, there's a number of them. Rolling Off a Log is a good one. Blackberry Quadrille.
How does Rolling Off a Log go?
It's in two keys. So it's called Rolling Off a Log. In the main, they call it Upriver.
Mm-hmm. upriver. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, what else?
Well, those, another jig that I like is Maid of the Mill. Mm-hmm. It's a Morris dance tune, but it's also an early American tune. So there really is, you know, it depends on who's playing it, and we have favorites. Like I like Speed the Plow.
Yeah.
But I like it as the English version played in the key of G. Mm-hmm. And so they don't play all the heavy notes. And mm-hmm. I like that. And there's others. I can't just bring them to mind now, but there's others that would be good for them. But some would be good one night, not the next night. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. Depending on?
On the dancers, the weather, mm-hmm. you know, the hall, the time of the season.
Your yeah. mood.
Yeah, yeah. Or well, the dancers' mood.
Could you use like yeah. Road to Boston, Red Wing, Cock of the North? I don't know if that helps at all.
Yeah.
Welcome Here Again.
Yeah.
Well, the other night we did St. Anne's Reel, Crooked Stovepipe. What were those other couple that I couldn't play?
I don't know. Leather Away, the Wattle O.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah. But in Nelson, that one. There was a couple of others.
Yeah. Hmm.
He's got a million tunes.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I don't use them all, though. You know, it, back in the day, a fiddler only needed to know maybe 20 or 30 tunes, and that would suffice for the lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in after learning new ones. They preferred the old ones and mm-hmm. didn't really want to learn anything new. There's that book called 66 Years of Fiddling. It's about George Overlock.
Mm-hmm.
His son put the book together, and George was a fiddler in this area, right around here. And he played for dances, and the favorite dance was Lady of the Lake. They'd do it three times a night, four times a night.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And he had a list of tunes, which included Campbell's Are Coming and The White Cockade and tunes like that, and that's one the ones they used.
So they do it three or four times a night with the same tunes every time?
Not always.
Yeah. So you could do it a few times, but with a different tune each time?
Yeah, if they wanted to. Bob McQuillan wrote new ones all the time, and they, you know, I never got the feeling that George Overlock wanted to learn anything new. And I know Dick Richardson didn't want to learn anything new, and he fiddled for me. He just mm-hmm. liked the old tunes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm more inclined to be like that than I am wanting to learn something new, but I learned a new one today from, I haven't found out about really how it goes, but I learned it from Pascal.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called The Waves of St. Lawrence.
Oh, I don't know that tune.
No, it's nice.
Lots of learning from him.
Yeah.
How has what you call and play changed over the years? Like, you've had a really long calling career.
Yeah. Well, when I first started calling dances, I only knew a couple of squares, Crooked Stovepipe and Darling Nellie Gray and Golden Slippers. And then when I did contras, it was Lady of the Lake, Chorus Jig, Money Musk, Petronella, Hull's Victory, and that's all I did for contras. And then when and that went along pretty good for quite some time, and I had a large crowd of kids following me around. But it changed. Like, you know, these things change. And new callers came in. It was quite easy to get a contra dance band going. It's not like a rock and roll band, you know. You mm-hmm. buy yourself a fiddle and you're in business. And but anyway, the competition became very stiff, and the youngsters wanted more difficult dances and faster, and that just wasn't my cup of tea. So I started, and then the Canterbury Orchestra stopped playing for a while, and then my partner Patty and I broke up, and so I was doing stuff on my own, and I found it was, about that time I was also working in schools, and dancing with kids in school is a lot different than dancing with back to the land hippies, you know, and so I started doing some very easy whole set dances, and I got those from the community dance manuals. But then I went to England, and I found out what they were doing over there, mm-hmm. and then I went to go back and found out what they were doing up there, and that's what that was the change, mm-hmm. and that's what I do now, and only once a great, great while. Maybe four times a year I'll have a bona fide contra dance where mm-hmm. I call the contras. Otherwise, it's the other things.
So to see if I understand right, there was a lot of different competition among callers and bands.
Yep,
And it was going in a direction that you didn't want to go
yeah.
in.
Yeah, well, I hadn't really too much choice. I mean, I just wasn't getting hired.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to struggle now to get gigs.
Yeah.
We don't. I mean, I don't do much in the way of advertising or soliciting, but don't have as many as I used to have. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2 years, 3 years in a row, I had over 300 gigs a year.
I can't even imagine.
But wow. The last couple of years, it's got down to about 80 or 90.
Yeah.
That's still a lot.
That's still a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I play about 100 gigs a year.
Yeah,
so
that's
I can't even
good.
Imagine doing 300. That's a busy schedule.
It was work.
It was work.
On the road a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Your star falls and new people come along. And that's okay because it shows that the dancing is healthy.
It's like a living tradition.
Yeah,
and
but it's something we have to deal with ourselves. It's nothing we can't take it out on the crowd.
Right.
You'd like to, but you can't.
Right. As long as the dance doesn't go in a direction that'll make it extinct. You know, like people tell the story of like modern Western square dancing and how it got so complicated that then, you know, you had to be in a club to do it and
wear an outfit.
Yeah. And now concha dancing, the magic of it right now is that you can go anywhere in the country and you can do it.
Yeah, could you used to be able to do the thing with Western square dancing too.
Yeah.
Not only in the country, in the world.
Yeah.
And but it's same thing's happening to the contra dance. It's getting more complex and more adaptable to people who like it complex. But David Millstone said that he sees on his observation has been that the contra dancing is on a low ebb.
Mm-hmm.
It's blowing down. And that's happened. It's happened in this current revival since I first started. I've seen it do that twice.
Mm-hmm. When were the first times you saw it do that?
Oh, it was when I was... when I stopped working with the Canterbury Orchestra, I went into a low ebb then, and it was sort of built back up again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first time it started building up was after the Beatles came to town, and then right after that, Bob Dylan. And we hit the bottom and bounced right back up again.
Mm-hmm.
But both those guys, the Beatles and Bob Dylan, contributed a lot to our popularity.
How so?
Well, they had a following, you know, and a lot of those people... sort of left the cities and went back to the land, and they found the contra dance was fit their image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were dancing with they were touching each other. It was a rock and roll, you don't, but not always. And it just fit their image more of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the Beatles, more Bob Dylan, but the Beatles just the same.
Yeah. So ebbs and flows happen in all sorts of things.
Oh, sure.
So... you know, you have the perspective of someone who's, like, seen this come and go a few times. What's your take on what's happening now?
Well, we don't do that much in the way of contra dances, so it's really hard to tell.
Yeah.
But in general, up in central New Hampshire, for the most part, it's a aging crowd. There's not too many young people. We don't see them, but we hear that here in Belfast they have a terrific young crowd. Yeah, and other parts around the Boston area there's some young people, but I don't see it up in Concord as much. There's once in a while a bunch of kids will come in from St. Paul's School, but it's not a regular. There's not any regular kids. One of them that dances quite a lot. What's her name? She's here.
Teresa.
No, Lake George's friend. Plays a fiddle.
Oh, Sarah.
Sarah, what's her last name? Well, anyway, she's part of that young crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's here, but she's one. You know,
yeah.
There's a lot of young people here, though. And
how about a Nelson? Do you ever go to Nelson?
Oh, you know, well, we played for dance there the other night. There were hardly any real young kids there. It used
not
to be.
Really young, no.
It's an older crowd.
It's probably 5 years since I've been there.
But they get a younger group from...
Well, they're Monday night dance, they get a young crowd.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the Monday dance where I saw a bunch of teenagers and stuff like that.
Well, they get them from that music school in Sullivan. There's a music school
there.
A lot of kids come from that. But during the wintertime, they still get a good batch of young kids.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see it, so we're not seeing too much of the way they're dancing. But some of the callers... really will do dance. Almost every dance has a hay in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if not that, a gypsy. And those are all English terms. And we never did. Well, the colonials, early American dancers, they did the hays. They didn't do gypsies, but they did the hays. And then it just stopped, I would say, you know, around Civil War, they just stopped using those terms. Well, a lot of it was, you know, telling England, go to hell, you know, by no hands. And so that didn't change until Ted Snuller and Donnie Parks and what was the other guy, Tony Salatin, started putting some of the English moves back in to the dancers. Mm. So they started doing the Haze and the Gypsies. I think a Gypsies are easy enough, but I don't enjoy it. And, you know, that eye contact, I just don't like it. You know? When you're going by, say, on a Gypsy, you know. Yeah. I remember one time I was in here in Maine. They were doing one of those ones, two your partners beside you rather than across the room. What are those called? Beckett's, yeah. And so I was dancing a Beckett, and so I had to do something with the opposite lady, and she said, "You're supposed to look me in the eye." Who says?
It's a lot of eye contact.
Yeah.
When I was just in England in March, and when they dance contras over there, they don't use so much eye contact.
Absolutely.
And when they do what we call English country dancing, which they often call Playford, they don't do nearly as much eye contact as we do here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems, but did it always used to be that way? It probably didn't.
No, it was somebody who danced English dancing here introduced it. Mm-hmm. But if you tried that in some parts of England, then somebody would take you out of the parking lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not, and I hate it.
One of the harder things for new dancers. I had a friend who wanted to dance, and he's like, "There's people in my personal bubble. They're not used to having
a lot of women feeling assaulted.
Yeah.
Wild Billy Martin lived out in Oregon and Washington, and he said, "If I want somebody to look me in the face, I'll go to my eye doctor." and then Ralph Sweet used to say, he said, "What, have I got spinach in my teeth?"
Do you think the music relates to that at all? Like, do you think the changing music and dancing together are just a reflection of dancing, like changing times and different desires from the dancers? Or maybe dancing serves a different role in people's lives?
I think the callers are responsible for that. Most of the callers don't play in the music.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have nothing. A lot of them are afraid of the band.
Hmm.
I sense that some of them, they'll turn to the band, "Give me some jigs," and they'll look away. You know, and a lot of times they don't know what they're talking about when they say, "Give me some jigs."
Uh-huh.
And so in order to gain some of the attention that the band's getting, they write these more complicated dances. And then it becomes a competition between them and another caller as to who can write the most complicated, interesting dances.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a crowd out there that likes complicated. Their work is complicated work in computers and teaching and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They like that. They don't know how to leave it there and do something else on their recreational time. They bring that right into the work.
Yeah, they want to be like mentally stimulated in that way.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, you dance with your feet, not your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been times when I was dancing to some really complicated choreography and it was fun as like a change, like a variety. But I wouldn't want it to be the bread and butter of,
And the average crowd we play for can't even begin to do Haze and Gypsies. So I don't, because I don't teach, you know, I don't spend any time teaching, I just get them going. It's just the simple moves. But I know that, well, not so much Nelson, because Nelson had Ralph Page, but there are other dance places like in Canterbury, where I live. They had it was a Baptist community, so there was no dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Northwood, in the neighboring town, they had a lot of Baptist people there, and they didn't call them dances, they called them marches.
Hmm.
But they did some of the dances. But anyway, the town of Canterbury burnt to the ground in April of 1943, and they had a night where the temperature dropped down to 30 below in April.
Oh.
And a wind came through, a 60-mile-an-hour wind, and it rattled the stovepipe loose in the Grange Hall. That came down, caught the building on fire. And so anyway, it burned the church and burned two or three houses, and it burned didn't burn the town hall. Burnt the store in the Grange Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to raise money, and they didn't have a fire department. There were some people who lived to the west side of town. It was during mud season. They came to town to get their mail, and there was no town.
Mm-hmm.
And so to raise money to do that, they formed a band and in a Baptist town. That was a chore, but they had Paul Ambo played a banjo, and Ruth Rogers played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Waldron played the drums, and the minister, I don't know his name, played the clarinet.
Huh.
That was the band.
It was the contraband.
Yeah, well, it was a band.
Right.
And they did a lot of waltzes and polkas and foxtrots, but they would do two Virginia reels, Portland Fancy twice, the Paul Jones, and a Grand March.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't need a caller for those.
Mm-hmm.
And they used the same tunes and did the same dances, and everybody loved it. You know, that was just finishing when I came into town.
Yeah.
Now in Canterbury we have on January 26th we celebrate the birthday of Robert Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Burns Night.
Burns Night.
And then in February we don't do anything. In March we do a maple sugar party and a Irish party. Mm-hmm. You know, call it an Irish party. It's called the Wearing of the Green, and we play in the Sugar House. So we get our supply of syrup for the year. Mm-hmm. April we don't do anything, but May we do the Sweets of May. There's a dance called the Sweets of May. Then we do that, you know, wherever we can, town hall or our house. And then June we don't do anything. July there's the Canterbury Fair, mm-hmm. and the Morris dancers dance there. August we take it off. September we get to do from then until Christmas we have several nights. And on Boxing Day we have a dance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the different times and different venues, and there's, I don't think we could get away with running a dance on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
I don't think we could.
But, this would be enough. But yeah. It's more of a community kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Pull the community together.
Yeah.
Which you need in a small town more than
and Canterbury is a Canterbury is an upwardly mobile town. There's a lot of blacktop driveways and a lot of doctors and lawyers and professional people who sort of go to one and say, been there, done that. But there's enough people there so we can keep it going. And so there's a lot of communities around where, there's George Overlock, like I told you, play. I saw in a book there was a dance card that they were playing for the senior high school graduation in the town in Waldo County here. Mm-hmm. And they had Lady of the Lake on the program five times.
Oh.
It's a, wow. It's, they loved it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can dance with a different partner every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's fun. That's interesting.
But there was
what's
her name? I have an awful time with names, but fellow wrote did a film called Dancing in New England, and it goes around to different venues, and one of them is the Blue Goose Ballroom here in Maine.
Hmm.
And they're doing a dance. So the band is a clarinet, saxophone, drum, and piano.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a woman doing the calling, and they're filming the Lady of the Lake. And they're dancing it to Babyface, which is a foxtrot.
Huh.
So the dancing contradance rhythm, but the
wow.
basic rhythm is foxtrot. And and the caller, will you please go down the center?
What would you say?
Down the center. But anyway, it was interesting to see that. Please go down the center. And the lady's chain, it didn't stick to any phrasing because it went all across the hall. They danced one long line, and one side was on one side was the other. So they did the lady's chain. It took them a long time to get all the way over and all the way back. They didn't pay attention to phrasing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now people think a lot about phrasing. Yeah.
But I went to another dance one time in near Paris, Maine, down in the lakes, down in Sebago Lake. And they did a contra dance there, and they did Haymaker's Jig, Lady of the Lake, Boston Fancy, and Mountain Ranger were all pretty much similar. And when they went down the center and they came back, they wouldn't cast off. They came back to their new place and went right into the ladies' chain.
Huh.
Just said that would be so much easier to teach. Cast off is hard to teach, yeah.
Yeah. So can I share a thought with you and get your reaction to it? I'm curious.
Okay.
For me, like, I'm just curious as to like how the role of music and dancing has changed over the years. And from your world, like your corner of the world of music and dance, for me, one of the things that made me want to play for contra dances was, first of all, I was like, look at this. There's people, like you said, they're touching each other. They're having fun. They're in a room full of music. The music, like, lifts you and carries you, and it's really good. Like you talk about, they're really good music. And I love the connection between the music and the dance. And there's times when I've been contra dancing and other bands have been playing, like Crowfoot back in the day when they were still a band. And I just felt like the whole room was moving as one. You know, everyone's balancing together and swinging together. How does that fit? Like, when did that kind of thing start to happen?
I think it's always happened.
It's always happened. Yeah. That's what I'm wondering.
There are various degrees, various ways of doing it, but it's always happened.
Like, what I want to get at the heart is, what is the magic of contra dancing? Like, you can change the choreography, you can make it more or less complicated, but if you do too much to it, you lose its essence. It's like that fiddling you were talking about. What is the magic that makes that good?
Well, to me, it's all three things. The band, the caller, the dancers, and the music, and the hall. mm-hmm. and the weather. Mm-hmm. They all. I mean, when you go to a dance in the wintertime in an old town hall, and when you arrive, you can smell wood smoke in the air. I mean, it's very important to me, anyway.
Yeah.
But the to me, it's all of it. It's all of it. It's not about it. It's not about the caller. It's not about the music. Mm-hmm. Not about it. It's all of them together, mm-hmm. making it happen. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there are, nobody is, I mean, I'm aware of that, but nobody says when you come in the door, pay your way, and you've got to be part of this. They're going to be, anyway. You don't have to plan it. Mm-hmm. It'll happen by itself.
Yeah. People, because I feel like as long as Contra still keeps that essence of what makes it magical, I think the essence of Contra dancing is the kind of dancing that you don't have to know a lot to do it. Now there's a collar, maybe yeah. when people used to know the chestnuts. Like, you know, in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, they could dance chorus jig all by themselves. They don't need anybody.
Yeah.
You know, but most of the time, as long as you have a collar to tell you what to do, anybody can walk in off the street and do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find that modern dancers get caught up in, like, flourishing each other. And they're not dancing for the whole hall anymore. They're kind of showing off or dancing for themselves.
Yeah.
Has it always been that way?
Oh, yeah. Well, it all depends. Like Walter Hall. And Louis Pescarelli and some of those dancers from the Keene area, wonderful step dancers. Mm-hmm. You know? And Ralph Page raves about it. He said that Walter Hall and Louis Pescarelli are the best dancers in the Monadnock region, and they were. They were excellent. Mm-hmm. But they were just into it for the whole. I mean, they were part of the whole thing, but they were also getting a lot out of it themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is what I feel like good flourishing can be.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
you're yeah. having a great time and yeah. you're keeping it stimulating for you, but you're also there for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just curious as to...
We have to go.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Did you have any other questions?
No, I think that's great. We okay. have a lot of... I have a lot of fun recordings to look up.
Yeah. All right.
I can't wait.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit ContraPulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!